This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 47 of What's It Like. My guest is Robert Scoble, technological guru?
Or something.
I've certainly been in technology for a while.
Yeah, I'm chief learning officer for Rackspace, so I go around the world and interview a lot of tech executives.
That sounds like a fun thing to do.
Totally fun.
Where did you grow up?
In Cupertino, right about a mile from Apple Computer in Silicon Valley. My dad was an engineer and worked at Lockheed on missiles and stuff like that.
Ah.
Yeah.
Did you come from a large family?
I had two brothers. I was the oldest, So not too large.
So who had the greatest influence on your life growing up?
Probably, both my mom and my dad. My mom, because she yelled at me a lot, got me motivated. My dad, because he had that engineering background, and he always brought me to science fairs and got me interested in technology. And luckily, we were in the right place at the right time. You know, in junior high, I was in the junior high in 1977 when they got their first Apple IIs, and I helped unbox them and got a tour of Apple when they were one small building. So I've seen the whole valley really change over the last 30 years.
Do you know how your parents met?
Yeah, on a train. My dad was in the army, and he was traveling through, UK. And they met on a train.
How interesting.
And my mom's German, so European.
So what was the major challenge for you as a child?
Trying to please my parents, I guess. My mom would yell at me a lot. And so it was, yeah, she was very German, very strict. And my dad was very technical and very smart. And so doing well in school was important to him. And I wasn't good in school, and I wasn't, I'm not strict either. So.
Why was school so hard?
I just hated being in class. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I had the third highest score on the SAT in my high school, but I was like close. I wasn't the bottom of the class, but I was getting D's and C's. And, the counselor said, "What the?" I think he said, "What the? Why did you have such a high SAT score when you can't even pass, you know, everyday classes?" And I'm like, "'Cause I go out and learn from real people." You know, and I remember, even in high school, if I saw somebody working in the street, I'd go out and talk to them about what they were doing, and like, you know, studying a sewer crew and how they did their work, and That's always been interesting to me.
Have you always been a people person?
Yeah, I've always been pretty comfortable with that. I ran at Disneyland when my parents took me. I got separated and dealt with that pretty well. So,
did you always want to work in technology?
I didn't have a concept of a job in technology. I just knew that tech was always going to be a part of my life because of where I lived, and also Even in junior high, I saw, the world is changing while I'm here. So, because we got the Apple IIs, and I could see that happening, and I was excited by it and interested by it. In high school, same thing happened, and some of the kids I was in the computer club. I always liked playing the games or using the computers. A couple of the other kids really liked programming, and I never got attracted to that. I just never did it. It was too much math and too much sitting down, even though I was trying to do it, because I was trying to please my dad. So high school, the world changed over, and then college, I took off a few years and ran a consumer electronics store, and selling cameras and stuff like that, and stereos. And while there, I made friends with a lot of the Apple engineers and saw the world change. While I was selling cameras, the world changed from manual focus to autofocus. And then right at the end of when I was doing camera store stuff, the first digital devices came out.
Big changes.
And that's when I started going back to school in 88, 89. and started getting serious about going to school. So I graduated from high school in 83. So, you know, I had 5 years there, 7 years where I was doing this camera store thing.
What did you study in college?
Well, first I tried to do computer science. And so with a little bit of journalism, I always was interested in journalism and writing and taking pictures. And that was always my fun hobby. I just thought I had a mental image that you would never make a living doing that. And, you know, you'd have to get a real job. I never thought that I would be able to make a living at it. I always thought that would be a fun hobby that I liked to do. So, you know, at the camera store, I was there from manual focus to autofocus. And I remember arguing with the pros and they would say, man, nobody's ever going to use autofocus, at least not the pros. You know, the pros, us pros can focus and we know how to do it. And of course, now they all use autofocus, which is a common theme through my life, is this resistance to new ideas and new things and new technologies that people just resist them. And it's very fascinating to study. Even today, you know, they argue with me. It's like, oh, you're an outlier.
Well, they weren't wrong at the beginning of it. Autofocus wasn't very good.
I think they were even wrong at the beginning of it. It was actually pretty good. I mean, that's where I was like an evangelist. When the Minolta Maxim came out, yeah, it was slow compared to Canon today, you know, but I took it out and shot some sports with it. And it's like, this thing is faster than I can turn the lens. And, you know, the focus point goes and stops. Me, I have to sort of go past it a little bit and then come back, you know, because it's hard to focus, you know, exactly on the subject. And it's certainly hard to do that when your subject's moving at 6,000 miles an hour. And I, you know, I've shot now motorcycles at Indianapolis Speedway and stuff like that. Those things are moving so fast you can't autofocus. And in fact, the pros back then would have tricks. They would just focus on the ground where they knew the motorcycle would get to, and they would just take the picture when they got to that spot, because there's no way you can manually focus that fast, right?
Sort of a form of autofocus.
Very similar, right? Yeah. Only today's autofocus is so fast, you can just keep on the motorcycle and it'll focus as that thing's speeding towards you. It's really pretty crazy. But anyways, I was on two tracks. I was running the camera store, you know, part-time, and then going to school part-time. And at school, I met Steve Wozniak in 89 and started studying with him early in the morning. So he was taking a Spanish class, and Steve is the co-founder of Apple. And I interviewed him, you know, I stalked him for a little while. So I every time I would get off the bus and come to school, I would see his car there and it would be in the same spot. And I would get there like at 7:30 in the morning. And so I just kept coming earlier and earlier until I got there before he did. And he's such an engineering mind that he parked in the same spot every morning and at the exact same time. So he would get there at 7:01 or something like that in the morning. And so I just stalked him. And I said, hey, you're Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, right? And he said, yeah. I go, can I interview you? And he gave me the interview, and that was my first celebrity interview. But then I started studying with him because, you know, he would be in the cafeteria at 7 in the morning studying. And I'd be doing the same thing. And nobody came up to him. You know, I studied with him for at least a semester. And nobody ever came up to him and said, oh, are you Steve Wozniak? You know, here's the co-founder of Apple sitting in the cafeteria in the middle of this community college with all sorts of students going around. And nobody talked to him, which taught me a good lesson that often the society superstars can be sitting right in front of you and you don't even see them. Because you might not know what they look like, or you might not care, or whatever.
You might think they're too busy to take time for you.
Yeah, you know, there's a little bit of that, but I've had that kind of experience over and over again. You know, when I came back from Microsoft on my interviews, Larry Tesler was sitting right next to me, and he was VP of engineering at Amazon at the time, and he was a famous executive at Apple, and this was at the last row of the plane, not in first class or anything. And, you know, I've had experience after experience after experience like that where really interesting people are sitting right next to you.
Yeah.
You know, last Friday night, I was sitting next to a minor league pitcher, you know, and he had an iPhone. So I was like, oh, you have an iPhone. What do you do? And I pitch for this minor league team. And I'm like, that's interesting.
So what was your first tech job?
Well, the camera store really was people. Was understanding how people buy things. And because we didn't have computers running the store, I got to learn I learned 3,000 prices, 3,000 SKUs, and I memorized the prices because I was paid on commission. And if I was taking a minute to look up a price in a book, I was wasting my commission. So I memorized the prices 3,000 times, mm-hmm. and I memorized them twice, once for me and once for my main competitor that was in town. So when people came in, and of course engineers would bring something that looked like a spreadsheet, you know, with sound at camera, LC premiums, and you know, a couple other stores, and I would fill in the spreadsheet for them, and then they would go to sound at camera, and they go, "How do you know everything like that?" I was like, "I know it," you know. But that taught me some lessons that I even use today, right? If you have credibility and authority on your marketplace, people will trust you, and they'll get over their distrust of you as a salesperson. Mm-hmm. I also learned all sorts of buying behavior. For instance, we were a discount store, so we usually had high volume and not so much service. Although during Christmas, not so much service. Other times when I was slower, a lot of service. But I remember this one time when we had like 50 people in line, and we just split them up. You know, we would say, "Hey, who wants a point shoot camera, a small camera, or who wants an SLR?" And people would come over and gather in a group. And every single time, except for I think two or three times, the person who bought first decided what the rest of the group was going to buy. And that taught me an interesting lesson. And so I would always try to figure out who was going to buy first and sell them on what I wanted to sell. Hmm. And that usually worked. You know, usually you could tell somebody was a little bit itchier than the others, and you would sell them and talk to them, get them to buy, and everybody would just sort of go, "Yeah, I'll take what he bought."
So what exactly do you do now?
So I'm the chief learning officer for Rackspace, which means, and they don't really tell me what to do. It's a great job. What they do tell me to do is go out and learn about what's happening on the bleeding edge. You know, touch as many startups as you can. Go and see the people who are doing really interesting technologies, you know, or go into IBM's lab and understand what they're doing, or, you know, go see VMware and build a relationship with them. And, you know, just be out there and see what happens. And it's pretty interesting what's happened. I mean, last night I was doing this hangout with two guys who are starting a company that just launched this morning, right? Just by being there, you get business, you demonstrate authority on the marketplace for Rackspace. So Rackspace's brand is kept fresh, and people see, Rackspace is out there doing innovative things, and they're meeting the innovative companies, even if they're not hosted on Rackspace. So, mm-hmm. by doing that conversation, it brings a lot of good feelings to Rackspace when people think of Rackspace. Mm-hmm.
So do you always interview the people in different companies, or do you just show up and talk to them?
A lot of times it's like these guys, I saw their product 6 months ago. So sometimes I just hang out with them and see what they're doing, give them some feedback and tell them what I think, because I'm a heavy early adopter, and I usually have an idea of where their product will succeed or fail. Mm-hmm. But it's hard. It's harder and harder because now the world wants to get to me. And so it's hard to do that kind of consulting and just hang out with people. Usually it's, we're coming out with a product next week. You want to see it? Sure. You know, I film that and make media out of it, stuff like that.
What's the best thing about your job?
The meeting cool people, mm-hmm. by far. And seeing stuff before anybody else does, that's always fun. But I've had some extraordinary, last night I was talking to Jeremiah, who's about to go on a aircraft carrier for the first time. And I've had a chance to do that. That was extraordinary. You know, I got a private tour of the White House. Not everybody gets one of those. I saw the last shuttle launch and got a tour from NASA. I've had a pretty extraordinary life in terms of these kinds of experiences.
What's the worst thing about your job?
Dealing with the email. Yeah. Because especially when you build, I call it a weather pattern or a weather system, it's almost like a spinning hurricane. And now everybody who's trying to start a company wants my validation, you know, because I'm one of five people in the industry who can really validate them. And so now I just get inbound that it's just crazy. I can't even deal with it.
Everyone wants to touch the light, huh?
Yeah. And I'd say a little bit of the travel. I love to travel, but I love being there. Mm-hmm. You know, see, I love being at the shuttle launch, but you don't see the grunge work of dragging equipment through airports and stuff like that. That's not so fun, but being there is fun.
Do you like being famous?
I still, I'm not Paris Hilton famous. You know?
Well, a few more arrests, and you know.
Yeah, you know, got up the party scene, I guess. You know, I mean, I've talked to Ashton Kutcher and Chameleonaire and Will I Am. You know, people who are genuinely famous and have. I mean, I was sitting at dinner with Chameleonaire in the middle of Silicon Valley, and you know, 13-year-old girls were like, "That's Chameleonaire!" Ah! You know, nobody ever does that for me. You know?
Nobody ever.
I mean, I do get asked for my autograph at tech conferences, but it's usually, you know, by people like me who are like pretty polite and will just hang there and go, "Can I get an autograph?" You know, it's not like the 13-year-old going, "Ah!" You know, and yeah, it's a different thing. I mostly like it. Mm-hmm. First of all, it gets me, and like I was walking around Disney World and I met a couple entrepreneurs who knew who I was. Anybody who recognizes me, I know they're a geek, right? So that's one advantage of having this niche celebrity, you know, because I know they're in tech, or they care about tech, or they use tech, or they're a programmer, or you know, or something like that, almost without fail. Mm-hmm. Or they're just an enthusiast. One guy who runs the TSA line in SFO recognized me one time, but he's like, "I saw you on Leo Laporte," and you know, and it's like, "Oh, you're a tech enthusiast." I could tell right away he's tech enthusiast. He just likes you know, using the iPhone and stuff like that.
Is there such a thing as a typical day for you?
No, and that's what's really cool. It's I've worked myself into a job where I don't have an hour that's the same as the previous hour.
So what type of person would be good at your job?
Oh, somebody who is a little bit along the autistic scale, I think. And I have a son who's further along than I am. He's in the middle of the spectrum, and I'm starting to see, okay, he obsesses about, like, if you take away an iPad when he's not ready to give it up, he does not like that. He is not very happy with you when you. And I had that same kind of obsession about focusing on one thing, which has always been an interesting. You know, I remember one of the times I came back to the camera store after not working there for a year. The first thing I did was reorganize the whole store. And by doing that, I found a guy who was stealing, he stole about $100,000 worth of lenses without anybody figuring it out, because he would take the lens out of the box, put the box back on the shelf, and put the lens into a thermos and take it out. And so I found a lot of empty boxes, and I pointed that out to my boss. I was like, "Hey, there's something going on here." Of course, they caught him and got all the equipment back, which is... But yeah, that's sort of the focus. It's like I have that ability to sit there and just focus and block everything out. But I don't have the negative things that my son has, in terms of not able to read people, not able to, you know, look them in the eye and shake their hands and make them feel good. Somewhere I picked up that skill. So part of it's also intellectual curiosity about the world. You need to be able to sit with a minor league pitcher and understand his world. And that's not for everybody. Not very many people are able to ask lots of questions. I mean, you're doing that skill, right? You're asking lots of questions. And not many people have that ability to sit there and, you know, like talking to people who aren't like mm-hmm. them, I guess.
With more with Robert Scoble right after I tell you about the good work being done by St. Jude's. Every month I go to stjude.org and look at the bottom right-hand side of the page. This is the site for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, and the picture is their patient of the month. These are kids that really need your help. It costs over $1 million a day to operate St. Jude's. Although I'm not asking you for the whole amount, I am asking you to chip in. So go to stjude.org. I also added St. Jude's to my Facebook page. After all, how could you not like St. Jude's. So, Robert, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
One thing is the world is in charge of my calendar almost. I've opened up my calendar so that people can schedule me for an hour a day. So unless I'm just going to say I'm sick and I'm not going to get out of my house, I have to at least do that minimum level of thing. And of course, at some point I have to share their videos and post their, something about them. So that keeps me motivated to generate content. So that's the driving attention management device, I guess, that I've built into my life. I remember going to Tim O'Reilly's Foo Camp, and I thought it was the most cool event. The first hour I got there, I was sharing apples with the two guys who started Google and a famous venture capitalist from Israel. And I was like, okay, this is a different kind of place. Mm-hmm. And after 2 years there, he kicked me out because he wanted to get new blood into the event. And I was like, man. In fact, a group of us either got kicked out or weren't invited that year. And that's how Bar Camp started up. It's Bar Camp's. The founders don't like to call it this, but Bar is sort of Bay Area reject. So, Bay Area reject of Foo Camp. And I told Tim, well, you know what? If you're not going to invite me, I'm going to have a Foo Camp every day of my life. And, that was 7 years ago, and it's been pretty good. It's been a rare day that I haven't had a Foo Camp day, which is really remarkable.
When you have to calm yourself, how do you soothe yourself?
That I don't have too much of a problem with. I have lots of kids and it's always fun. I'm trying to get back into riding my mountain bike and going and doing some exercise. That helps me get back in a creative mood, I guess. I listen to a little bit of music, but I'm also doing a lot of driving. So driving causes, it's hard to do anything on the computer screen while you're driving. It's pretty if you try, right? It's a good way to win a Darwin Award. So there I listen to music or books on tape or talk radio, and that gets me out of my world and gets me to maybe think a lot mm-hmm. while I'm driving, and I have to drive nearly every day. So
is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Yeah, actually it's interesting. So in 2001, a lot happened in a very short time. 9/11 happened. I think 9/11 was September. I got hit by a lady in my car and ended up upside down. And that totally changed my outlook in life. It's like, oh, if I'm going to get whacked by a random event, I'm going to have fun while I'm here. And I'm going to live harder, I guess. And that caused me to get divorced from my first wife because I wasn't having fun there. I got engaged to Miriam because that was a lot more fun. we shipped a product. I was working for Dave Weiner back then. I laid myself off. I was running the books. So I knew we were running out of cash for a couple months. And we tried to do stuff to change that, but it just wasn't working back in the best times of 2002. My grandma died, and there was something else in there too, and then I got married. But ever since then, I remember thinking, man, my life is really sucking right now. What is going on? There's so much chaos, and I'm out of work, and that March, I'm out of work, and so much has happened, and I just remember, okay, if I'm in a hole, I just have to dig out and make every day a little bit better than yesterday. Mm-hmm. And that's been the trajectory. Now it's harder, but the trajectory still is trending up, which is great.
Is there an idea or a principle that helped you through all of those challenges?
I don't think so. I think it was just chasing what do I want to do? What turns me on? If I'm going to be laid off and if life is going to whack me someday, like I was in this car accident, what am I here for? And what turns me on? What do I want to do? And I would just keep working toward that goal, which was doing what I'm doing now. I'm I can't see much of what I would change in my life.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college graduation, giving your best advice, what would you say?
Make the most of where you are. One of my favorite friends, Buzz Brueggemann, he went to school to Duke Law School with two other kids. And the kid at the top of the class is still his friend in Seattle. He got a job at one of the top law firms in Seattle. Buzz sort of went and did his own practice for a while and did all right. But, you know, he's not rich and he has lots of friends. He has a good life, but he's not rich. He's not what you would think of as successful. The kid at the bottom of the class couldn't get a job, at least with the law firms that everybody thought that the school was training you to work for. And so he had to take a job with a small little startup up in Seattle that nobody had ever heard of. He was the first lawyer at Microsoft. And so he's done better than the other two by far, which shows you sort of the weird path through life that people take. I remember the CEO of Seagate used to be a dope addict and surfer, right? And he sort of said that life led him to being an executive. And I've heard lots of stories like that. My own story, I remember being in journalism school. And journalism school is, we're going to train you how to be a newspaper reporter. You know, that was sort of the most glamorous thing that all the teachers there thought, you know, would think as their the highest calling possible in their profession, right? Well, I knew, first of all, they made you get an internship. And I knew by going through the internship process that there's no way I was going to get a job at a newspaper and certainly not one that paid any money. So I took this job with a small computer magazine and I've done better than pretty much anybody in that school, which again shows you the randomness of life is don't follow the crowd. Don't feel compelled to follow the crowd. Follow what makes you get up in the morning and be excited about getting up. And the rest of it tends to take care of itself.
My last question is to help me get better at this process. We all have events in our lives that shape us or stories. So think of a defining moment in your life that we haven't talked about. What questions should I have asked you to get you to tell me that story?
Well, I'm going through a process right now of thinking of starting my own business. And somebody asked me a really good question the other day that was pretty hard to answer. They said, "What do you want?" And I'm like, you know, some people would have a really strong answer. I want to make $1 billion. That's not what drives me. You know, I already have what I want. So it's really hard for me to answer that question. Mm-hmm. I guess once you get to the place where you have everything you want, then you start saying, well, I want to share that with other people. But that question is still burning in my mind. I don't have a good answer to it. And when I do, I think I'll write a blog post.
I want to thank Robert Scoble for joining me today. Thanks, Robert. I appreciate it.
Thank you.